Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. Welcome, everyone. Today, we're diving into the, well, the luminous, but often quite challenging literary world of Madeleine Thine, a major voice in contemporary Canadian literature.
Absolutely. She has this incredible way of exploring vast historical events, particularly, you know, the political turmoil in 20th century China.
Right. But she does it through such a personal lens, family, memory, and maybe most importantly, music.
It's a huge canvas she works on. So today, our main focus is her big novel, Do Not Say We Have Nothing, won the Giller Prize. It's this sprawling, epic piece.
Yeah, truly epic.
But to really get the full picture of her artistry, we thought it'd be great to contrast that with an earlier, very powerful short story, The Book of Records. Much more intimate.
Good idea. So our goal today is really to unpack how Thine uses art, could be a complex piece of music, could be just a desperate song sung alone, how she uses it not just as a topic, but as the actual means of survival.
Yeah, how memory gets carried forward when, you know, the official histories are being actively wiped out.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's unpack this. Let's start with the novel, Do Not Say We Have Nothing. It's huge, covers what, 7 decades?
Pretty much. It chronicles the persecution of artists, intellectuals in China over that time. But interestingly, she doesn't begin with some grand historical sweep.
No, she starts small, with a girl.
That feels really key, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Our way in, and yours as the listener, is 1991 Vancouver. We meet 10-year-old Marie, Canadian-born.
And into her life comes Aiming, who's fled China. Her father died around the time of the Tiananmen Square protests.
And Aiming's arrival is like the tremor that starts to crack open all this hidden family history. It really forces Marie to confront her own father's deep, deep silence.
Mm-hmm. And the core idea, the really heartbreaking premise, is how art, which seems so fragile, right, becomes this ultimate form of resistance. Music, literature, they become tied to basic human dignity.
So the story really asks you to weigh things. What's the cost of just surviving versus maybe the price you pay for keeping your artistic soul intact when the system is trying to crush it?
It's a heavy question. And the emotional core, I think, for tracing this history is the Shanghai Trio. 3 musicians at the Shanghai Conservatory back in the 60s.
Right. Their lives are all tangled up. And they almost represent this whole spectrum of how artists respond or are forced to respond under pressure.
So first, there's Sparrow, the composer. His idealism, it just gets crushed pretty early on. He's kind of the tragic figure whose dream of, you know, revolutionary art gets twisted and ultimately broken by the state.
His story is just, it's painful. You track what happens when the government dictates what you're allowed to create.
And then Zuli, his cousin,
yeah,
a brilliant violinist. For her, watching their culture, even their physical instruments, get destroyed, it pushes her to become more radical.
She's the one who just won't compromise, isn't she?
Exactly. She refuses to bend. And tragically, she chooses death over what she sees as utter humiliation. It's the ultimate sacrifice, like saying some things, some truths are worth dying for.
Wow.
But maybe the most complex figure, for me anyway, is Kai, the pianist.
Ah, the pragmatist.
Yeah, he's the one who adapts. He finds ways to navigate the political demands, compromises here and there, just enough to keep playing, just enough to survive physically.
But wait, that raises a question, doesn't it? If Kai compromises to survive, maybe even to keep the music alive in some form, does Thine present that as a failure? Or is that pragmatism a kind of resistance too, a quieter kind?
Well, that's where it gets really nuanced. Kai's survival is.
Yeah.
It's messy. But because he does survive, he's able to carry the stories.
Mm.
So his compromises, maybe they seem less like a moral failing in the end and more like this incredibly difficult calculation someone had to make to ensure someone remembered.
Okay. So he carries that weight.
He does. And that weight, that burden, it eventually gets passed down to Aiming, the Tiananmen survivor we met earlier.
Yeah. And Aiming then becomes this crucial link. She's the one who teaches Marie, the daughter growing up in safe, distant Canada, that her father's silence isn't just quietness, it's inherited trauma.
Right. She basically gives Marie the history lesson her father couldn't, the history that led to his withdrawal.
So when we talk about the history in the novel, it's not just dates, it's visceral. The Cultural Revolution, especially, is like this furnace at the heart of the book.
Oh, absolutely. Those scenes,
Yeah.
the Red Guards destroying instruments, burning music scores, it's about state-sponsored cultural violence.
Is Thien suggesting it's literally cultural genocide, or is the threat more about controlling ideas?
I think it's both, really. Smashing a violin, burning a skull that's wiping out the physical artifact, the record, that's genocidal in impulse.
Okay.
But the subtler, maybe deeper threat is targeting music itself, something abstract, nonverbal. Why? Because it represents an inner freedom, a way of feeling and thinking that the regime just can't control.
So art is both a safe place and a dangerous place to be.
Exactly. It offers escape, transcendence, but it also marks you.
And the way Thien tells the story, the structure itself makes you feel this fractured history. It's non-linear, jumps around in time.
Yeah, which sounds academic, maybe, but what it does is put you, the reader, in the shoes of someone trying to piece together a traumatic past. You get fragments, echoes, you have to work to connect them. It's not served up neatly.
Right. Memory doesn't work chronologically when you've been through something like that.
Which brings us perfectly to this central symbol, the Book of Records. This secret manuscript, pieces of forbidden music copied down by hand, hidden away.
That's the ultimate private resistance, isn't it? Keeping the art alive when it's officially banned.
Precisely. And it connects to that quote you brought up earlier. Music is not political until it becomes memory.
Yeah, explain that a bit more.
Well, a piece of music, just as sound, might seem innocent, abstract, but once it becomes linked to a memory, especially a shared memory the state wants to erase, then it becomes history, then it becomes political.
So just humming a forbidden tune becomes an act of defiance.
Yes. And think about the title itself. Do not say we have nothing. It comes from the international, the communist anthem, a song of hope, of solidarity.
But in the novel.
In the novel, it becomes this bitter, devastating irony. The characters look around, see what the revolution has actually cost them, love, art, dignity, and they realize maybe that the promise was empty. Maybe they've been left with nothing.
That feeling, that huge national silence covering generations of trauma, it sets up the contrast with the next piece really well. We go from that vast scale to something intensely private in the Book of Records.
We really do. It's a total shift in scale, from decades of history to one family's living room in Vancouver. This is from her first collection, Simple Recipes, and it's all about grief.
And the premise is just, it's so unique, almost bizarre, but heartbreakingly so. We have a young narrator whose father, a very quiet man, is grieving his wife. She loved to sing.
And his response.
Yeah.
He decides he's going to break the Guinness World Record for the longest continuous singing marathon.
It's such an extreme act, isn't it? For a man defined by his silence, he turns their living room into the stage for, like, a feat of vocal endurance.
And the daughter, the narrator, she becomes the official timekeeper. She has to log the songs, the hours, everything.
So as he sings for days, the only glimpses we get into his past, into his relationship with his wife, are through the snippets of songs he chooses. Little flashes of their life in Borneo, maybe.
Exactly. The singing literally becomes this bridge, connecting his silent, grieving present back to a past filled with her voice, with shared music.
And the climax, or the turning point, it comes as he gets close to the record.
Right. The media shows up. Suddenly, this intensely private act of mourning is a public spectacle.
Yeah.
And under that pressure, the exhaustion, he starts to crack. He becomes delirious, starts talking to his late wife through the songs. It's not about the record anymore. It's about reaching her.
And then he doesn't actually break the record. His voice gives out.
He falls short. The reporters pack up and leave. But that quote-unquote failure is actually the revelation.
Yeah, it shows that the whole point wasn't the Guinness Book entry. It was this monument he was building out of sound, an act of pure devotion.
That nails the theme, I think. Incommunicable grief. He can't talk about his sorrow, so he has to perform it. This marathon is his way of expressing love and pain when words just aren't enough, which happens in families, right?
Totally. And it creates this amazing contrast between two kinds of records. You've got the Guinness Book, this Western idea of measurable public achievement.
Right, empirical validation,
And then you have the daughter's logbook.
which is the real record. It doesn't just have times. It has the emotional truth, the effort, the strain, the specific songs, the moment his voice finally broke. It's a testament to his love.
It proves that the records that matter most are often the private ones, the ones that capture the human spirit, not just the stats.
So if we connect these two works, the hidden manuscript of forbidden music in the novel and the father's singing marathon, the end seems to be showing us how extreme circumstances, whether it's political oppression or profound personal loss, push people into these extraordinary acts, acts that defy being silenced or erased.
They're both fighting to hold on to memory, onto identity, when the world is trying to take it away.
Exactly. And maybe the shared message here, running through her work, is that the moments that are truly heroic, truly significant, they're often the quiet ones, the private acts of remembering. They won't be in the official histories.
They reside somewhere deeper. So Thien really pushes us, I think, to look beyond the official narratives, the public achievements. Mm. She makes you reevaluate the kinds of records you keep in your own life, the family stories, the songs that hold meaning, the private journals.
And to trust that the creative impulse, whether it comes out as art or just as an act of intense love, that impulse persists.
Yeah.
It finds a way, even when systems try to crush it.
A powerful thought to end on. The persistence of the human spirit through art and memory.
Yeah, it really stays with you.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Apatra Foundation.